Hi everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. I am your host, Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, I talk to illustrator Barry Blitt. Among other topics, Barry tells us why showing his drawings to Major League Baseball players in hotel lobbies helped start his career. He gives us an inside look into how he and art editor Françoise Mouly of The New Yorker have worked together for decades to create more than 100 covers. He describes his process of illustrating a cover from start to finish, and he also provides a bit of insight into the self-critical nature of illustrators, whether they're drawing, painting, playing the piano, or chatting on a podcast. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I hate talking about myself, so I'll get through this somehow. I'll try not to be too, absurd and flip.
Don't worry, I'll be absurd for the both of us, believe me.
No, you won't. You're not absurd. It would be great if this got absurd. That would be fantastic.
Let's do it. Let's take it.
Veered off track.
Oh, we're already off track, so we haven't even begun yet. I usually like starting off with a very simple question. Where are you from?
I am from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I grew up in an extremely Jewish suburb called Côte Saint-Luc that was once mentioned in National Lampoon because it had a higher a concentration of Jews than Israel did. And, I was surrounded by, people exactly like me. Well, actually, this is starting off completely wrong, but I grew up in a very sort of, there was not a lot of culture in my house. We were, big baseball fans and hockey fans, but I didn't see copies of The New Yorker and certainly not, any Modiglianis or anything like that. But I was, drawing from a young age. My grandfather used to copy Norman Rockwell paintings. And so, that's culture, I guess.
Yeah.
But that was the extent of it. But so I was drawing caricatures and cartoons and copying Mad Magazine at 5 or 6 years old.
Was it one of those things where you just started drawing and never stopped drawing? Because I feel like I have kids who are at that age where they still enjoy drawing, but now they're kind of, there's a sort of a self-awareness that's kind of seeping in. This morning this happened. My daughter was drawing a vase of flowers and started off with a line and immediately thought and said out loud, that doesn't look like the vase. And so she started again, and I had to sort of interrupt and say, no, just draw it. Enjoy the process. Enjoy the drawing. It doesn't have to look exactly like the thing you're looking at. It just has to sort of feel like it. And, sort of it's an expression. It's your expression of this thing that you're looking at.
How old's your daughter? Like 19 or what are we talking about?
Nine.
Yeah. Well, yeah, my son draws extremely well. He's 23. But I always remember a drawing he did. He copied the Mona Lisa when he was probably 3 or 4, and it's just a fantastic drawing. And he's never really, when I tell him how great that drawing is, he sort of looks at me funny, but it's just so unselfconscious. And you don't need me to remind you that Picasso said that artists are forever learning how to draw like children. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, the naive eye they try to reacquire in their later years.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Exactly. But I feel like at that age, at 9, 10, I have a son who's 12, you either continue on the course of being an artist and wanting to express yourself artistically in some way or another, or that self-awareness really takes over and you kind of give up and convince yourself that you're just not an artist, and then you can't draw, and then that transitions out to, I can't even draw a stick figure,
And pretty soon you're an accountant. I mean, yeah, it's about trying to be playful, as an adult.
Yeah.
Not just being an artist, but, leading an enjoyable life. Mm-hmm.
I assume you had family support with your drawing as a kid, and that's sort of led you and helped supported you out into art school, or should I not assume that?
Absolutely. No, I had total, complete, overwhelming, you know, and unrealistic support from all of them. Particularly my grandfather, who, as I mentioned, you know, drew left-handed as well, and was, you know, he was proud of me, and we were close. But my parents too was just mostly uncritical support. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would draw baseball players and bring them to my dad and show them to him, and he would say, "Oh, yeah, this." I mean, he would tell me when they looked like the person and when they didn't, and I guess he was the only critical eye in the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to. My parents, that the dad was the critic, the mom was the support. So I would show my painting or my drawing to my mother. It was great. Show it to my father. That doesn't look anything like that thing that you just drew.
I think Milton Glaser talked about it, the importance of having, you know, one of each, one parent who was, you know, gave too much praise and one not enough. I don't want to misquote Milton Glaser, but he said something like that. I mean, my dad would be critical, but he was a big supporter, and that's why going to art school after high school was I wouldn't say a slap in the face, but it was cold water. It was some other kind of metaphor that was an awakening. You know, was realizing how many people did this so much better than I did. And
where did you go to school?
Well, I went to Concordia University in Montreal, did a couple of years there, and then I wanted just to go to art school, so I transferred to Ontario College of Art. I moved from Montreal to Toronto and went there for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was great for me. There were a lot of great artists came out of that school, a lot of great illustrators.
And still do.
Still do, God knows, yeah.
It's a great school. Did you know then, as a junior, senior, that editorial illustration was your path, or did you not know what your path was going to be?
As I said, I'd never seen the New Yorker magazine. I was pretty sheltered. I had no idea. I mean, I figured I would be doing caricatures somewhere in a hotel lobby or something like that, which, you know, would have been fine.
Yeah.
I mean, around the same time, I sort of had a side thing going. I was, as I mentioned, a crazy hockey fan and baseball fan. And I used to bring a friend. We'd go down to the hotel where the opposing team was staying, and I would draw a couple of pictures in advance, and then I would show them to the players when they were, you know, coming down to go to the ballpark or whatever. And I ended up, you know, doing drawings for several yearbooks, for some hockey yearbooks and programs and stuff. So I started getting published that way I mean, I didn't think about editorial illustration, but I did think about, you know, doing sports caricatures. And
I assume this is then Les Expos, Montreal Expos.
Yep.
Moises Alou, Gary Carter.
Wow.
Andre Dawson.
Tim Raines. Steve Rogers. Yeah, well, they took the Expos away from us. And it's very hurtful that you're mentioning these names. I mean, I was an enormous baseball fan, and when the Expos were moved to Washington, I cut baseball out of my life, which freed me up to do a lot of other things, because I spent a lot of time, you know, following the game.
I don't have personal experience related to this, but I'm from Baltimore, and so Baltimoreans do have experience in having a team taken away from them literally overnight.
Which team was that?
The Colts.
Oh, that's football or what?
Yeah.
I don't have any, I'm sorry, I guess I should, you know, empathize with you, but I don't feel anything.
Well, that's okay. So you graduated from college and...
cut that out, can't you?
Yeah. No, I'm going to leave that in. I'm definitely going to leave that in.
It's all right.
All right. What was your first big... job?
Well, I mean, I was doing the sports thing. I was drawing baseball players, but that stopped being a realistic thing maybe when I got to be 18 or 19. I mean, it was cute when a little kid was doing it, but, you know, being basically an adult, almost an adult, and doing it, waiting around in hotel lobbies for baseball players, I lost interest in it. Mm-hmm. And then, I went to college. one of the first things that happened was sort of heartbreaking. I was asked to do an album cover for a big Canadian band, April Wine. I don't know if they had any presence in the United States, but they were big up there. And I worked on that for a while, and at the last minute, I don't think they liked what I was doing, and they had someone else do it. Gotcha. And that was sort of heartbreaking. I went to art school, and they gave a scholarship to work in an ad agency, and I worked at Leo Burnett in Toronto for about a year. And that made me realize that advertising wasn't for me. There wasn't enough drawing, and I just didn't like the culture wasn't for me. So that was and I liked a lot of the work that was coming out of Britain at the time. They were great illustrators, you know, in the very early 80s when Russell Mills and Ian Pollock, there was just a ton of great illustration from there. So the day that art school ended, I went to England and lived in London for a year and, of course, ended up in an ad agency there. Mm-hmm. After about a year of that, I just thought I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I came back to Canada and sort of moped around for a while, but then started bringing my portfolio around and eventually started getting editorial jobs.
For whom?
For whom? For Toronto Life magazine, for Canadian Business magazine, mm-hmm. for I think Canadian TV Guide. You can imagine what Canadian TV Guide looked like.
Actually, I can't, but...
Yeah, probably just lots of pictures of Gordon Lightfoot, I guess. And then I eventually started sending my portfolio to New York City. I remember coming for a couple of American illustration weekends and then going to see art directors while I was, you know, in the city. And
and they would just, call them up and they would say, yeah, come on over.
Yeah, you'd call them up and they'd see you. I don't think that happens much anymore.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine what it would be like to start now. I guess a lot of emailing or putting pictures in the mail. I'm not sure, but
yeah, that's something that I talked about this with Steven Kroninger as he was coming up in the 80s. You know, you would just literally pound the pavement. I'm using the word literally, meaning actually.
Right, in its literal meaning.
In its literal meaning. And, you know, you'd walk around, you'd meet up with art directors, they'd say, yeah, come on by, and they would look at your portfolio. And if they liked what they liked, then maybe you get a job.
That's the way it worked. I mean, I remember going to see Stephen Heller, and he gave me a job right away, like, while I was there. And seeing Chris Curry at The New Yorker, she came out and saw me in the lobby, and called me not long after that.
Why was it the lobby? Was it just like, I'll meet you in the lobby, you're not coming up?
I guess she was busy in her office. I never asked her why I was showing her stuff on the sofa in the waiting room, but that's the way it worked out.
Yeah, that wasn't on the top of your mind, like, why can't we go upstairs?
Yeah, no, I was just happy to be to be talking to her. And actually, one time when I was bringing in an illustration, because obviously back then you didn't scan them, I think I brought it in myself, and she said, oh, Françoise Mouly is just starting here, and why don't you come say hi to her? And she introduced me to her, and I met Françoise, and at the beginning I was doing cartoons for Françoise, like not the black and white cartoons, but she was doing page cartoons, and I was submitting sketches for covers. And yeah, then just during one telephone conversation with Françoise, she said, oh, by the way, Tina, who was Tina Brown, the editor at the time, said, why don't you go ahead with that smoker's idea for a cover? Just casually, she mentioned it at the end of a conversation to me, Françoise. And of course, it freaked me out and scared the hell out of me and probably aged me 5 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. And that was a process in itself, getting that first cover done.
That was an idea that you had at first, that you shared with her.
Right. I had sent her some ideas, one of which was because I lived in New York City at the time. I had moved there in 89, and I was seeing people standing outside. It was a new rule. You weren't allowed to smoke inside you know, inside office buildings. Yep. And so there were all these people standing outside smoking, and I thought it'd be funny to put them out on window ledges, you know, so you'd see a cityscape and the buildings would be dotted with people standing on window ledges smoking. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea she told me to go ahead with. And I sent her, I mean, I brought in some final, I still get extremely nervous. I guess it maybe everybody does, doing a New Yorker cover, and I'll draw it as many times as time will allow, and I'll send in several versions. And I think I probably gave her five or six versions, and they were not good. And she could see how nervous I was and how I tightened up. And she told me, she said, why don't you talk to Ed Sorel? He's done lots of covers and his work is so loose. And and I said, I'm not talking to Ed Sorel. I mean, you know, who could one be more afraid of than Ed Sorel? But then I guess she talked to him because Ed called me and invited me to his house, and which was like a really big deal for me. And a big moment in my life, you know. I brought him the drawings that I had done, and he looked at them and said, oh, these are terrible. What the hell? You know, where did you get these buildings from? And I said, I just made them up. And he said, no. He says, some people can make up, you know, what they draw, but I can't and you can't either, obviously. And he showed me the books that he would use. He showed me how he would go about drawing it. And he just scribbled something. I mean, very, very loose, but he – and I immediately went out and bought lots of books about New York architecture and skylines and stuff, and you know, handled it the way he told me to, which I ran into him several months later after it had come out, and he said, oh, I saw your cover, you know, we can't do our best work all the time. Like, and
well, at least he's honest.
Ed is nothing if not honest.
Was that note basically like, don't draw from your imagination, try to understand what it is that you're drawing, was that the big comment, or were there other bits of advice that he was sharing with you that sort of helped you kind of, you know?
I think, I mean, that was a big part of it. It was good to know that. Also, just seeing the way he worked, I mean, he started off real, real rough, you know, and I don't know that I did that. I think I've always started just putting ink to paper and trying to draw the final in one fell swoop, you know, and, when that works, it's magic. But, you know, I don't know about anyone else's batting average, but mine was pretty low. You know, you're starting out I mean, Alan Kober is one of my favorite artists, was one of my favorite artists. And he would just start a face, you know, he'd start with one eye and draw the whole thing. And with the other, when he got to the second eye, if it wasn't in exactly the right place, there was a charm in that. And he made it work, but I don't have that skill to do that. So, it needs to be something with buildings and you know, a certain narrative. It needs to be worked out, and I don't think that I was willing to do that before I talked to Ed.
Mm-hmm. How much time did Françoise give you for that cover?
Well, it was like she uses the term a run any time cover, so it was not. I mean, I've done covers lately that, you know, I've got a few hours to do, and it's something topical, which seems to be where I've landed these days, doing, you know, topical, late-breaking stuff. But for this one, I had months to do it, I think. Mm-hmm. And so the months were filled up with drawing this thing over and over again.
How many New Yorker covers have you done?
It's a sickening amount. I'm not sure the number. They alerted me when it was the 100th one, and that was maybe a couple of years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm bad with time, and I'm bad with numbers, but it's, you know, it's far too many, probably.
You were saying that first cover was a nerve-wracking experience, that you had tightened up. Has it gotten any easier?
I mean, now I look back at that one and wish the current ones look like that one. It has not got easier, no. Not a bit. It's gotten harder.
It's gotten harder in what way?
I mean, first of all, I'm more self-conscious with each one. And I'll be doing a drawing and I feel like I've done this before. I should be taking some chances with it. And that's hard to do on something like that where there's a lot riding on it.
There are a few covers in particular that I just want to touch on. Obviously, I would love to talk about all 100 plus, but we don't have the time.
Well, thank God.
The one, the Politics of Fear cover is one that you've talked about, and certainly people, there are a number of people listening, hopefully, fingers crossed to this, that will already know where I'm going, but it's the cover where Obama, where the Obamas are fist bumping, and they're both essentially dressed as terrorists.
Yup. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, do you?
Oh, I mean, I'll talk about it, sure. It was...
Was that your idea? Or, like, what was the ideation process there? And then we'll go from there.
The ideation process was, I mean, I was... It was the campaign of, what was it? 07, 08. Obama was running, and I liked Obama. And everyone I knew liked Obama, but, you know... Since I mean, I moved to the country in I moved to the United States, and as I said, at the end of '89, and I'm amazed by some of the things I hear and see. And I was listening to Rush Limbaugh when I first moved here. I'd never heard anything like it. And so I'm very aware of. I mean, for what I do, I have to listen to, you know, I listen to right wing media as well as left wing media, and read all kinds of crazy stuff. But there was a lot of stuff being said about Obama, who seemed like a very middle-of-the-road politician, but they were talking about him as if he was a terrorist. They were talking, I mean, him and Michelle at some event fist-bumped each other, and on Fox News they called it a terrorist fist-bump. And it's, you know, my Francoise, God bless her, insists that I don't self-edit, and I send her whatever I've got. You know, there's been times when I've said, oh, I had an idea, but I'm not going to send it to you. It's too crazy. And she insists that I send her, you know, whatever I've got. So one idea that I scribbled was just doing a drawing, like a tableau of making visual everything that they were saying about Obama and Barack and Michelle. They were saying she was a... what were they saying? So she was a Black Panther, and she didn't. Then she was racist against whites, and it was just there was a lot of horrible stuff being said. So I just drew it all in one picture and sent it to Francoise, who got it right away and thought it was hysterical. And she, you know, brought it to the editor David Remnick, and he got it as well. And I think he was talking about, you know, we'll run it sometime during the campaign. And Francois was saying, this is the moment right now, you know, let's do it right now. And I got the go ahead, and I had a day to do it. And I couldn't believe I was being allowed to do it, because I knew it was sort of a naughty picture. You know, it was, I knew where it was coming from, but part of the controversy is built into the picture in that, you know, who it's attacking is not pictured. You know, it's seeing them through the eyes of people who aren't in the picture. Well, one of the early sketches, we had Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter looking in through the window, you know, seething. But that seemed like it was one step too many. And anyway, I did the drawing overnight and brought it in to into the city the next day, and I remember I walked with Francois down to the department where they scan stuff, and the imaging department, and the technicians there were looking at it a little nervously. And I thought, you know, what am I getting into here? And of course, like, you know, it came out, you know, the following Sunday, I guess the advance copies of the issue come out. It was, the internet was just, I mean, there wasn't as much internet presence as there is now, but I started getting calls on Sunday night when it was released to the press, and the joke landed very clumsily, and not everyone got it. Let's just put it that way. So it was a scandal, you know. It was for a few days. It was a pretty hideous reaction that felt like it was worldwide. You know, I was taking a lot of flack. My email inbox, you know, maxed out at 1,000, like immediately. And And yeah, it was quite uncomfortable for a few days. It was on TV news and stuff. It seemed to die down actually after The Daily Show, after Jon Stewart did a little commentary about it and said, folks, it's just a cartoon, and he seemed to get it. And then it, you know, then I was back on solid food by Wednesday of that week.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, leading up to that, like, for instance, I had the Chicago Symphony wanted me to do a drawing for do some drawings for a brochure of theirs. And as soon as this cover came out, I heard from their designer saying they're no longer interested. And yeah, I was supposed to play music at I play a bit of piano, and I had a gig lined up at a bar mitzvah, and they also canned me. So there were career repercussions right away, but it's been fine since.
That's early days of cancel culture, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, if that had happened today, I think it would have been much harsher on me, and but the whole situation would have been more inflamed, although it's hard to think of it as any more inflamed than it was. It was pretty rough. I mean, yeah, cancel culture's always been around, you know. Mm-hmm. You say something or do something derogatory, stupid, evil, whatever, there's a price to be paid for it generally. But this, you know, I really do feel this was misunderstood.
I mean, for what it's worth, and it's not much, but my view of that cover, and I remember it when it came out, I thought it was as clear as day. That's what people were saying about the Obamas, and you were visualizing what folks were saying.
Right. Period.
There was nothing much more than that, in my mind.
Well, a lot of the criticism of it was, I get it, but what are the people over there going to think? You know, and
the criticism came from
the left, mostly. Yeah, I don't think the right cared for it either because they saw themselves in it. But yeah, I don't think anyone liked it really.
Was of all the covers that you've done, and obviously you've done a number of them that touch on some pretty raw political moments like Katrina and so on, was that the biggest, did you receive the biggest reaction from that one cover, or were there other covers that were worse?
Absolutely. No, that was the worst. There have been others. I mean, I still get plenty of nice hate mail, but you know, it's okay.
A few weeks ago, I was watching the news, and they did a tiny little segment about the upcoming New Yorker cover. And I was minding my own business, not thinking of anything. And up popped your cover of Giuliani and Trump as mobsters pushing a cement-footed Uncle Sam off a bridge.
Right.
And I looked at that and I went, that's Barry Blitt. I'm going to talk to him soon. But then I thought, immediately after, geez, I wonder what the reaction to this is going to be for him.
Yeah, it's been nice. There's been hardly any death threats at all.
Hardly any death threats. That's a great title for a memoir.
Right. And I'm kidding. There were none. And I don't think I've ever got death. I mean, I've gotten some ominous emails, but no, I've never got death threats.
Right.
But, you know, the night is young.
So when I think of like political editorial illustration, I immediately start thinking of Thomas Nast.
Yeah.
You know, he did a number of political illustrations that quite literally affected multiple presidential campaigns. His illustrations were credited as taking down Boss Tweed in New York at the time. There's a story that the Tammany Hall politicians and Boss Tweed specifically offered Nast today would be $500,000 for him to leave town. Yeah, I mean, there's one great illustration from him. It's called The Brains, and it's essentially a very large Trump-esque figure, actually, with a bag of money as a head.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's an amazing drawing.
It's fantastic. His nickname was the President Maker. Anyway, so Thomas Nast was certainly one. These days, I mean, there are a number of illustrators who've done political-themed illustrations who've gotten into serious trouble. I mean, there was one illustrator who worked for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Yeah, Barbara Rogers.
He was fired.
Mm-hmm. And Michael D'Adder was fired in Canada.
In Canada.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Have you thought about, like, has anything remotely close to that come knocking on your door at all?
No. I'm trying to think about it. No, I mean, I...
Or is that a dumb question?
It's not a dumb question, but it just, it, first of all, I mean, I do political themes, but I wonder how, I don't think I'm doing what they're doing. You know, they're exposing corruption and, you know, I don't think I'm doing that. My stuff's kind of, it's a little superficial.
Well, I don't want to disagree with your own view of your own art. But I wouldn't see it as superficial. I'd see it more as a reactionary or commentary on what people are saying and thinking and doing.
I mean, I'm looking for laughs, basically. That's my that's my number one. I hate to say that, but I think it's true. I mean, it's nice to come up with a nice metaphor and now and then for something that's going on and have you see something in a new way. But I don't know. But no one's offered me any money to leave town or to leave the room or even.
It's funny. I was a little bit nervous this morning thinking about our recording because of your wit and your humor.
Luckily, none of that is in evidence this morning, is it?
Well, definitely not for me. I felt I needed to be funny for some reason because of you and how funny you are with your work. And I, hopefully by saying this out loud, I have excused all future attempts at humor for my part anyway.
Yeah, I think you're doing a great job.
In terms of process.
See, now you're making me feel self-conscious and I'm going to have to feel like I need to be funny.
Definitely not. Please do not.
Okay, good.
Don't be funny whatsoever. Okay. As far as process goes, can you take us through a hypothetical cover, let's say? Let's do a little role-playing. I'm an art director for The New Yorker, God willing. I contact you. I say, you know, let's work on a cover together. What next?
Okay. Well, I mean, the process starts before that. I mean, I'm regularly sending in scads of ideas. You know, I'm scribbling in a sketchbook, especially when something's going on. If there's a, you know, they're going to impeach Trump, I'm filling a sketchbook with drawings about that and trying to do funny drawings or trying to come up with interesting ways of seeing it or different, you know, metaphors or whatever the hell. I'll send in 10 or 15 sketches of a cover idea, of different cover ideas. And then hopefully I'll get a call saying, from Francois saying, I'm going to show this one to David. Or very often I'll send 15 in and none of them are remotely working. But if there's one or two that there's a possibility, it's shown to the editor along with whoever else sends in stuff. And if I'm given the go ahead, then I mean, coming up with the ideas is the fun part, but having to render it is, it gets very nerve wracking for me, but that's a matter of sitting down with a, you know, watercolor block and pen and ink and watercolor and sketching it lightly in pencil first and then drawing it maybe several times, as much time as I've got, you know.
What's nerve-wracking about it?
Just because it's in sort of a bit of an unforgiving medium, although you can fix things digitally and like on the cover that you just mentioned, the Trump and Giuliani throwing Uncle Sam off the bridge, though, I sent in the final art and they weren't happy with the likeness of Trump. And so I drew several more Trump heads and emailed those to them and they did surgery on it and put the Trump head they liked on it. Mm-hmm. But it's nerve-wracking because it's as I said, an unforgiving medium. You know, you're working with a pen and ink and drawing a line that could go, you know, infinite different ways, and you want the line to look fresh and you want it to be loose, but at the same time, it's got to convey an idea or a narrative, and it's got to tell a story, but it's got to look. I mean, it's so often the type of joke or the type of concept that you're dealing with, it's got to be reflected in the artwork. You know, if you have a sort of a crazy idea, let's say, you know, something that's extremely whimsical, you wouldn't want to draw it extremely realistic. You'd want it to look, sometimes you want the drawing to look thrown away. I've done some, a cover comes to mind of Hillary and Obama when they were running against each other in 2007, and they're both in bed reaching for the phone for that 3 o'clock phone call, mm-hmm. 3 o'clock in the morning phone call. That was a campaign ad by Hillary. Who would you want answering the phone? And I mean, I did the drawing. I didn't have a ton of time, but I wasn't happy with the likeness of either of them in it. But I sent it in anyway, and it somehow sort of worked because it was drawn so quickly, and it looks like it was drawn quickly, and it sort of suits the idea. But anyway, I mean, it's easy to get bogged down in mental craziness when you're doing something like this. It is for me anyway. You know, should this be drawn tight? Should this be extremely loose? And then you get into colors, and it's just, there's so many ways to go wrong. And you really got to turn off several voices in your head when you're doing this. So that's why it's a fraught process for me anyway.
Right. How do you turn off those voices? Like, how do you fight through that self-consciousness?
I mean, sometimes it's a matter of having not slept and desperation and because another thing, Françoise likes to have the artwork. She likes to have it picked up. You know, I will send a detail, like a high-res scan, but if there's time, there's often a driver coming, you know, and he's waiting outside, and I have to finish the thing. And so that helps turn off voices, just the, you know, time.
Have there been moments where the driver is just literally outside and you're working on the piece?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, lots of times. And they're saying, you know, more sienna in it, you know, more burnt sienna, a little sepia over there. They're giving comments.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so I don't like asking this question, to be honest with you, but I have you here, and I would kick myself if I didn't ask it.
Uh-huh.
Like, what tools are you using? What types of watercolor, paper, you know, take us through that.
I don't see why anyone would want to know that except to avoid those particular tools. But I use a Croquill pen, you know, like a 102, Hunt's 102, like a dip pen, mm-hmm. which is really it's a little bastard. I don't know why I still use it, but I mean, I guess you press harder and get a thicker line. You can get nice effects from it, but you know, every second one you pick up is got something wrong with it. And then I use, you know, just black ink, sometimes mixed in with a little non-waterproof brown ink, so it'll spread a little bit when you put water over it. And I use a Canson watercolor block, cold pressed.
What kind of watercolor is it?
Oh, just tubes of different kinds. I couldn't even tell. I mean, I can go get them if you want. There's some Winsor Newton. There's another one with a French name.
do you use Dr. P.H. Martin?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of those.
This might be a dumb question, but are you happy with your work?
That is a dumb question. I'm just kidding. It's not a dumb question. I don't know. It's painful. I think too much, you know, and so it's hard to look at anything that I've done and be pleased with it. If the magazine is pleased with something, I shouldn't rely on other people to validate my own work for me, but it's become hard not to. Mm-hmm. Isn't that pathetic?
No, it's not. And I think it's relatable. I think a lot of illustrators.
I didn't say it wasn't relatable, but.
How long have you been working in illustration now? What is it, 30X years?
Yeah, 30X. It's been, so probably over like 1985 I started, something like that. So it's a little while.
Have you given any thoughts to sort of how things were compared to how things are today?
Well, certainly it seems like there were so many magazines. When I was, you know, visiting New York and bringing my portfolio around, aside from the fact that people would see you back then, and I don't know if they do now, and just there was so much illustration being used, and I think it would be, you know, much harder to start now. I mean, you asked about how the business has changed, and recently I started doing a regular online cartoon for the New Yorker. It's just like a weekly, it's a sketchbook kind of thing, and I do it just runs online, and I send it in maybe Thursday or Friday, and it's up on their website for a couple of days, and then it's gone. It's sort of eerie, you know, that, I mean, I used to do a drawing, and it would be in the magazine, and it would be printed, and I still get printed work, but to do something online where I guess the bulk of editorial is now, there is something phantom about it, you know, and where it's just gone. It's sort of not going anywhere, you know. You see maybe people retweeting it or putting it somewhere, but it doesn't exist anywhere, and that's a little disconcerting for, you know, an old print guy like myself.
You mentioned playing the piano earlier.
Did I?
You could obviously decline. I'm imagining that the piano isn't somewhere within striking distance.
Oh, it absolutely is.
You wouldn't mind playing a little blues, would you?
Wow, that's so sad.
Why?
I'll totally do that, but I don't know. There's something that really, like this old guy. It's like one of those, you know, one of those CBS, you know, human interest stories where the old gets up and what takes 10 minutes to walk over to the piano and then plays a T for two or something.
You could play something more uplifting.
Okay.
Okay, I've got the...
It's too humiliating. I'm not going to do it. I've got the upright in the other room, but I can't bring the computer there.
Gotcha.
That would be a little less humiliating, but still humiliating.
I want to ask why that's humiliating, but I think...
Okay, why is it humiliating?
Yeah, why? I mean, you can play.
I can play a little bit, but I don't know, there just seems like there's something sad about it. I think maybe I should up my Wellbutrin.
I have to say, I talk to a lot of illustrators that come through the school, and this sort of overly self-critical part of an illustrator's brain, why is that so freaking powerful? Why do so many illustrators listen to it?
I think that plumbers and accountants get it too. But I mean, I'm just speaking for, you know, personally, I can't talk about my entire vocation, but just for me, I mean, I'm trying to be a bit of a jerk, and I'm always looking for vulnerabilities in people, you know, in my work or stuff to make fun of. So you can imagine, you know, what's going on in my head, you know, thinking about myself.
Right.
Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
So I do have some nice afternoons.
So I want to tie this conversation up and on an uplifting, tangible beat.
Okay.
Remembering that with us is sitting listening an illustrator who's trying to get into the business in some way, shape, or form. And they're just looking for a little affirmation, a little information, a little inspiration, etc. What would be one piece of advice that you'd like to leave them with?
I think, I mean, I can only speak from experience, and I have found, I mean, since I've been in the business, I've seen people with just amazing, you know, visual style. And that seems to be temporal, you know, it seems to come and go style-wise. I think the most important, what I'm trying to say is that I have found the most important thing to be is to have good ideas, you know. Mm-hmm. That does not seem to go out of style. But even that's probably not true. I mean, I guess the quality of the ideas trend as well as visual styles. So what I'm saying is there is no hope. No, what I'm saying is that from my perspective, I think that a big part of this game is having something to say and and developing, you know, a point of view or a, you know, just the cerebral side of it is very important. And that's, you know, and I guess with that comes the self-criticism. And, you know, when you're thinking a lot and stuff, it's a double-edged sword, even a triple-edged sword. But I think ideas are the thing. Keep a sketchbook and I mean, you know, this is not news. The most fun for me is sitting around with a sketchbook and, you know, where there's no one looking at it but me, you know, and I can just mess around and entertain myself. And if you can keep yourself entertained, that's, you know, that's the first step to, you know, entertaining someone else with, you know, with your work.
To learn more about Barry, visit barryblitt.com. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it online, subscribe to the podcast, and leave us a positive rating and review. This helps us find new listeners, and on a personal note, it would be nice to know that the podcast is helping. Continue the conversation in the comment section of each episode at illustrationdepartment.com/podcast. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.